Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.
Welcome back to a special early morning edition of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Quinn Kesnick. We have so much to talk about. An unbelievable opening Thursday night to May Madness. Quinn, it's a rainy morning in Baltimore, and I think it's because the lacrosse gods are sad that games are getting less and less as the action is getting better and better.
Rise and shine, everybody. Get your hands on the wheel, your eyes on the road. If yesterday, Thursday, was any indication of what Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and the NCAA tournament are going to be like, with upsets, with drama, with outstanding performances, we're in for quite a treat. You know, that stands out to me from yesterday, and then the finality of everything, Terry, you know, with seniors playing their last games. A lot of these elimination games, you lose, you go home, you pack up that hefty bag, and you clean out your locker room. So I feel for the seniors. And keep that in mind if you're associated with a team who stays alive, a team who's gunning for a league championship or into the NCAA tournament, and how that feeling of finality has got to drive you to play your best ball right now.
31 Division I men's games left this season. You talk about upsets, you talk about drama. It is very difficult to pick a place to begin when it comes to analyzing Thursday's action, but we're going to start with the big, Big East upsets. Marquette 10, Denver 8. Coach Joe Amplo's team did it again. Unbelievable effort out of this squad. I was impressed by the offensive ability to take advantage of opportunities, build a lead, and then hold on late. And for me, the biggest difference in the result of the outcome was Zach Melillo and what he was able to do with the faceoff X against Trevor Baptiste. You know, just an unbelievable effort out of the Golden Eagles. And I think the thing that impresses me most is that despite the fact that they didn't play very well against Denver last week, this is still, it's not as if they took Denver by surprise. This is a Marquette team that there was a revenge factor that still existed with Denver from last year, and Marquette was still able to win. Unbelievable.
I think it was the greatest setup loss in the history of the sport last week. These two teams played the last game of the regular season. Look for that to change. I don't think Coach Tierney is going to be happy with the scheduling, having to play Marquette back-to-back. Did they beat him 16-8 last week? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, and it was worse than that. Marquette scored a couple goals late to make the margin a little bit more flattering.
You know, it's interesting. When I saw that last week, I'm writing about that in my poll, how great Denver was, and then you realize that, well, Marquette probably didn't show them very much, and it was an experimental game knowing that they're going to play him the following week because those brackets were set. So you got to give Joe Ampo and the players a lot of credit for being able to turn that you know, an 8-goal deficit, giving up 16 to all of a sudden playing great defense against Denver. And that's what stood out when I was watching portions of that game. I was switching back and forth. Yesterday was crazy with all the available games. I wish it was more nationally streamlined so we could go straight through from like 10 a.m. to midnight watching games and not feel that there was three on at the same time. But anyway, defense really buttoned up. They understand Denver better than anyone. And so I think if you're going to be playing the Pioneers in this tournament going forward, I think the first place you look is how Marquette defends them, both last year and this year. Gritty effort, and I just got to give them credit, and sets up a very interesting final in the Big East. And they steal a bid, quite frankly. Rutgers, I just don't see. Maybe Army with a win over Notre Dame, but who are they going to leapfrog, Terry? And even Albany with wins over Yale and Binghamton. If they don't win the America East title at noon on Saturday on ESPNU, what kind of case can you make for Albany as an at-large? So that game had gigantic national implications.
There's no question about that. I do want to come back to the bracketology after we get through some of these conference tournaments. But real quick, one note to address Albany's resume at the very top. UMass became a top 20 win by virtue of their victory in the CAA semifinals last night. Albany's RPI rose to 6. They now have 3 quality wins. They have the opportunity to add a 4th. Obviously, if they do so, it's a moot point because that means that they've won the America East AQ. But three quality wins, none of them are top 10 wins, so it's not like it's really separating themselves from the pack. But Rutgers right now only has two quality wins and not as good of an RPI. But as we've already discussed, they're already out. So a couple more points, the comments I want to make about this Marquette game. John Wagner led this offense. He had four goals. It was unbelievable. I was really impressed by Grant Preissler and what he was able to do. He scored two goals in the third quarter, one being backhanded. That really felt like it separated Marquette down the stretch and gave their team belief as they continued to kind of parry away some of these Denver efforts to get back into the ballgame. I thought it was really, really impressive from a guy who hadn't scored a ton of goals coming into this one. I think he had seven career goals leading into his senior season and had about six coming into this game. It was a very, very impressive performance, and I think those are the types of heroes you need. Seniors, a senior from Mercer Island in Seattle, stepping up late to make sure that your team is in good position, and they were able to build a two goal lead at multiple points in the third and early fourth quarter, and then John Wagner with the go ahead goal with about 8 minutes to go. Ryan McNamara got another one to give him an insurance goal with about 4 minutes to go. Denver was never able to get a reasonable look at tying this game in the waning minutes of the fourth quarter.
Conference rematches, when they put teams meet in the regular season, then meet again in these tournaments. We're going to see rematches in the NCAA tournament. They're super tricky. They're unpredictable. Good coaching matters. Strong-minded players, I think, matter. And to me, that was what was most impressive about Maryland's win against Penn State. You know, that's a team that they had taken care of earlier in the year, and a very businesslike Terp team showed up, and that's important in these rematches. You just gotta bear down. It's not going to be pretty, and you're not going to be as emotionally charged in a neutral environment. You know, you think about that also. You know, Providence had the home court. But for both Denver and Marquette, it was a neutral game, and that can be difficult because there's not as much juice in the air.
And on that note, the Providence Friars emerged 10-7 victors over the Villanova Wildcats in the other Big East matchup, a 3-2. For this one, the story to me was Providence's defense. I thought that throughout the entirety of the game, but particularly in probably about the last 20 minutes or so, the way in which they continued to compete on ball impressed me so dramatically. And it was to the point, and there's one specific play that stands out. It was to the point that it felt at times like Villanova thought the game was over. With about 5 minutes to go, there was a one-minute Villanova possession that included multiple turnbacks with about 15 seconds before Devin McNamara scored what would be Villanova's final goal of the game. Christian Cuccinello had the ball at the top of the box. He had pulled out of a dodge after getting double team, and Gerard Newman stayed with the double team. He continued to hound him so badly. Cuccinello fell down and basically just desperately threw the ball behind his back. It ended up falling, I believe, to Jack Curran, who assisted McNamara for the goal, and it gave Villanova life because it made the game 9-7. But for the preceding, it felt really unfair for Providence because for the preceding 1 minute, they just hounded Villanova's offense all over the field to the point where at that point in the game, I was like, I don't see a path back for Villanova because Providence is playing with so much passion and so much energy this late in the game. I mean, just it was so emblematic of how Providence was able to pull out this win. But really difficult to talk about this game without talking about Tate Boyce's 16 saves. You know, Boyce has been a guy who, ever since he kind of came to this program, recruited by John Galloway, there's been optimism around what he could be in the sense that it was a stable building block for a Chris Gabriella coach team that was always going to lead with its defense. And I think that, you know, he showed on Thursday night exactly where that was coming from, exactly where that optimism was coming from, and ultimately led this Providence team to victory.
Defensive-based teams are dangerous in the NCAA and these league tournaments because if your defense can travel, you bring it on the road, and it becomes a foundation for everything, and so it shrinks, obviously, the margin. Now, goal-scoring teams did well in last year's NCAA tournament. We had some high-scoring games, and I think ultimately to win a title, NCAA, you're going to have to stand toe-to-toe with a high-scoring team and counter back and get to double digits. But for a team like Providence, defense, goaltending, that's what they do. That's what Coach Gabrielli is going to hang his hat on. And it should be interesting. You know, I would anticipate a low-scoring, slow-possession game against Marquette.
Let's move on. The moment of the night. This clip has more than, I think, 1,300 retweets on SportsCenter's clip that was tweeted out. Dan Muller, with 1 second left on the clock, gathers a loose ball, lets loose probably a 35 or 45-yard shot, and it beats goalie Jack Kincannon to give UMass a 13-12 victory in the CAA semifinals. Unbelievable play.
I got a question. Yeah, I got a question. I've watched it. It's hard to see. I was wondering later this morning if the folks at Inside Lacrosse could clip what happened to get to that point. Was there some kind of turnover, and was it an offside? There's a restart near the midfield line. Where's the goalie? Where are the defenders? How come no one's in his face with a stick up? How did this happen? I see the end result. I don't know why the goalie didn't make the stop. I can only imagine. But how did we get to that point? And to me, that would be interesting if you guys could do some kind of video breakdown of the last 15 seconds.
The only context I can provide looking at the box score is that UMass was a man down. So in addition to all of the chaos in terms of resetting, Hofstra had an extra man on the field. And I think that ultimately what it came down to was the belief that the game was kind of over and we were going to overtime because it was tied 12-12 after Josh Byrne knotted the game up with 4:14 to go. And I would imagine that from Hofstra's perspective, they had scored 5 of the last 6 goals leading up to that point. They felt like they're, you know, the game was kind of in hand because they had pulled off that comeback. And even more than that, they had scored 8 of the preceding 10 goals. At one point, UMass was leading this game 10-4 with basically 21 minutes left to play, and Hofstra battled all the way back. The fact that they weren't able to close out this comeback is an incredible footnote to the way that this game finished. Not only was it an upset, not only did it finish on a buzzer-beating goal, but it featured this incredible, furious comeback out of the Hofstra pride. Exactly what people love about March Madness. That is what we had in this game played at Towson. It was the last moment of the night on Thursday night, and it just totally reset the perspective on how the rest of this week was going to unfold.
Quarter buzzer beaters are critical. You know, we saw Ohio State Hopkins scored with no time left right before halftime, and which was an important goal. But those goals are killers, and obviously, to end a game or in overtime, they're going to be you know, exclamation points. But you know, reminder, all levels, you got to play out the time. You can't rest with 5-10 seconds to go. You really got to play through the echo of that last whistle.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Heinrich's goal right before halftime for Providence against Villanova put the Friars up 6-4. It was off of a faceoff violation. There was some confusion about the restart and picking up the ball. And he let loose about a 50-yard goal with 1 second left on the clock. So definitely a theme of the day for sure. But in the other CAA semifinal, Towson took care of business as the Tigers emerged victorious over Drexel. Felt like a relatively workman-like game. You know, to your point earlier, so much to watch, so much to consume, not a ton to react to in this one. So let's move on to the Big Ten semifinals as the Towson Tigers get ready to take on UMass in the CAA championship. It was chalk in the Big Ten semifinals. Maryland tops Penn State 8-6 in the opening affair. I was at the regular season meeting of this game where Maryland parlayed a really significant faceoff advantage into a win in a high-scoring game. Penn State's offensive efficiency in that one was what kept them alive, kept them within contention. And I thought that
11 of, yeah, they're 11 of 24 in that game, possession-wise.
And I thought what was really problematic in this one was missed opportunities, particularly in the first half. In the second quarter, I saw Penn State fail to down 4-1, fail to convert on having a defenseman hung up, an extra man, and then almost a one-on-one with goalie Dan Morris, all within about a 5-minute span. And to me, not only did that suggest that, you know, Maryland's defense had shown up ready to play and was going to be in a position to make plays, but ultimately Penn State's offense was not going to be bringing that to the table in terms of winning the game for their team. And obviously Maryland was able to hold on down the stretch.
Yeah, I thought, you know, Maryland mucked up the faceoffs to try to make them 50-50, and maybe Penn State's quickness on offense was a little negated by the field conditions. But, you know, don't shoot offside low on Dan Morris. That's the scouting report on him. Connor Kelly from Maryland, unbelievable the stretch he is on this year. With his feet set, he doesn't miss. And then the confidence, you see him nail a left-handed goal, kind of dodging against the zone. He was unbelievable. Matt Rambo was quiet, but I thought he played a great game in drawing double teams and spinning the ball. Heacock looks like he's back to his normal self. And let's see how the Terps play on one day's rest on Saturday at 7:30 on BTN with Joe B. on the call. This is a team, win or lose, I think it'll help them if they do make Memorial Day weekend, because that has been their Achilles heel now with John Tillman at the helm. They're a very regimented 5-day of preparation team typically, and this is the greatest training ground possible. It's an opponent they know well, so it's not a strategic challenge, but it's a physical challenge to a team who runs their first midfield into the ground, quite frankly.
When you look at the box score for this, a couple of glaring things stand out. The first being that Penn State outshot Maryland 35-25, and despite the faceoff battle being even, they picked up 5 more ground balls than Nittany Lions did. The other side of this, Maryland made 16 saves and Penn State made only 5. Dan Morris's up and down nature of his season is really remarkable, and for a goalie that can show up and steal games, you know, that's a pretty good position to be in. It's as problematic when he doesn't show up and he might cost you a game, which I think a lot of people point to with respect to Maryland's loss to Ohio State in the regular season. But when he can put his team on his back like this, you know, it's a really good source of consolation and a really good source of comfort.
No, he'll bounce back, and he has bounced back from that effort. I know, speaking with John Tillman, that they've had some one-on-one sessions, and they're just trying to, you know, sharpen the razor. That's what you have to do late in the year. You got to peak right now. You can't peak on Memorial Day. You won't get there. You got to be playing your best ball right now. And you got to, as a goalie, you got to love the cauldron. You know, where every game could be your last. And I'd like to see a little more emotion out of Dan, but he's not that type of cat. You know, he's a cool guy from Dallas. He was great. You know, he's good and tight. You know, he fills up the goal well, and his top hand's pretty quick. And then from mid-range, he's really good getting the kick saves out. We've seen him multiple times this year making that offside low kick save when he goes to the splits. So he's tricky. He's a tricky, you know, I wouldn't call him much of a mover in the net, like a guy like, let's say, Fowler, with his ballistic quickness going from pipe to pipe. But Morris now is proven. I think his body of work over the year is what it is. A couple down moments, but I got a lot of respect for him.
I love the anecdote that John Tillman warms him up before games. You don't hear that very often of head coaches warming up their goalie.
Well, he's qualified. Remember, John Tillman played goalie coming out of high school and attended Colgate University, the Red Raiders back then, and then transferred to Cornell and switch positions. I took a downgrade to the defensive midfield position. But so he knows goalies. He knows how a goalie needs to be warmed up. And, you know, Terry, you've heard my articles about when I go to these summer club things and I see these guys in flip-flops and sandals and sun hats flinging heat from 5 yards on young goalies and destroying them in warm-ups, how important a goalie's warm-up is. John understands that. He's the right man for the job. And plus, he burns some calories, too. Tillman's super fit these days.
It's true. I, you know, dating back to, you know, my days as a goalie in high school lacrosse, was a huge believer in the importance of a systemic, regimented warm-up routine. I wanted guys walking across the arc from 15 yards, hitting all 9 spots, walking across from 10 yards right to left, and then finish with in tight, and then I wanted, if it was possible, passes from below GLE to above opposite side and same side so that I could get my patterns in terms of where I was stepping from pipe to the ball, and then I wanted to take shots all over that were a little bit more chaotic and less I knew where they were coming from. Not a lot of guys on my team were capable of doing that or willing to do that on a regular basis. And so, you know, if a head coach understands exactly what the importance of it is and says to the rest of his team, this is how my time is best spent in these pivotal moments pregame, I think it says a really nice message about what they want out of that goaltender over the course of that game.
Yeah, it's personal attention. If you're a young goalie listening to this podcast or a young parent and your son's playing on multiple teams this summer, laminate what Terry just said. Laminate, on a little index card, write down the shots that you want to see in warm-up, maybe 4 bullet points, laminate that card and bring it out to all your events and hand it to the guy who's going to be warming your son up. And it's just so you get those staple shots. Terry, I couldn't agree more with your routine. I found that I had my best success either coming off a super warm-up where I felt like my legs were in my hands, my eyes were just so in sync, or a horrendous warm-up where I went to the bench after the warm-up and like sat down and got some water. I was like, man, that was the worst. I am horrible, you know, and that served as a cattle prod, so to speak. So I either wanted a great warm-up pregame or a horrendous warm-up pregame.
All right, let's move on to the second Big Ten semifinal. This one was not decided by the goalie play, although Tom Carey, despite making 5 saves, had 2 very memorable ones in the third quarter. Ultimately, when Trey LeClair is dropping 6 goals, Ohio State's going to pull away to a 15-13 win. Johns Hopkins outscored the Buckeyes 8-5 in the second half, but could not overcome a 10-5 halftime deficit. Shaq Stanwyck had 4 goals and 1 assist, but once, like I said, buy stock in Trey LeClair right now. That Canadian converted on almost 50% of his shots, and he was complimented by Jake Weathers at the Faceoff X, who won 20 of 31 and picked up 11 ground balls and added a goal for his effort.
You know, the visual that stands with me more than any from this game is the handshaking. I don't know if you stayed tuned to it, but BTN was in no rush to get off the air, which is nice. And so you could see the Mohawk haircuts dyed semi-red-orange that some of these Buckeyes were sporting.
Oh, that was supposed to be blonde. It was just poorly executed.
That just tells me, man, this team is all in. They are fully invested. They got a little pirate chip and a little knucklehead in them, obviously. And you look at some of their hometowns, and that's understandable. And then you compare that with the buttoned-up Johns Hopkins, very serious and stoic yesterday. Didn't see much emotion from their bench. And I just love what I saw from Ohio State. It wasn't a perfect game defensively for them, especially late. Hopkins started dicing them with their passing game. But, you know, Jake Withers, their defensive midfielders compared to Hopkins, just much bigger, stronger, faster. And Hopkins defensively, you don't make saves early, sets a bad tone. And their shorties are just constantly preyed upon in a game of that magnitude.
Unbelievable, really. And one of the things that, you know, I'm curious now that Hopkins has lost 2 in a row, Ohio State rebounds from their loss to Rutgers last weekend. You know, when you just compare the number of guys that played in this game, Hopkins played, it looks, you know, just kind of at first glance, about 26, 27 guys. And Ohio State played about 21, 22. We've talked about that over the course of the season as it relates to depth. You know, you mentioned Maryland very reliant on their first midfield. As it relates to the 2 games in 3 days turnaround and what we see on Saturday night, I don't know that it's going to be much of an advantage for Ohio State because they didn't play a ton of guys themselves, and they played the faster-paced game. Meanwhile, you know, Johns Hopkins hopefully can now regroup. They are comfortably in the NCAA tournament. They're going to find out what their fate holds on Sunday night at 9 p.m. on ESPNU and start preparing. Hopefully, as you have said, having that many guys engaged and have skin in the game, really, are going to say, we need to play better, and that manifests itself in a great week of practice next week.
Yeah, the Jays, I think they've lost. I think their record in the last 10 games is 4-6. Double-check me on that, but 4 wins and 6 losses over their last 10. And the way they're playing right now, I can't see them getting a home game. I mean, you know, the way Duke played in the second half of the season, the way North Carolina finished the ACC tournament, even though Hopkins has a head-to-head, I just see those two teams as potential 7 and 8 type seeds, maybe Albany. And I think the Jays will go on the road to somewhere south. Or you know, I could see Hopkins as an 8-9 game going to a Duke or going to North Carolina, and they do have to regroup. So that'll be interesting. To me, the seedings are going to be fantastic. It looks like we're starting to get a 1-2-3, you know, 1-2 in order with Syracuse and Maryland. Ohio State's got to be in the 3-4-5 range. You know, the 6-7-8 is going to be tricky. You got Penn State, the teams I just mentioned out of the ACC. I don't see the Jays hosting a first round game. The way they're playing right now, they don't deserve it.
Well, first of all, you are correct. They are 4-6 in their last 10 games. They started 4-0 and have since lost 6 of their last 10. I do see them hosting a first round game, and once again, we'll dive a little bit deeper into bracketology shortly. I actually think
Duke, Carolina, and Johns Hopkins will all host. I think that Penn State and Albany likely will not. And I think that North Carolina has actually jumped up all the way to number six in terms of the way that I value their resume relative to everyone else. So I think it goes Carolina, six, Hopkins, seven, Duke, eight.
Interesting. Okay, and then Albany goes on the road somewhere as a 9-10 type?
Yep, Albany and Penn State would both fall into that category.
Gotcha. Good. Okay. Interesting.
Moving on.
Let's move on.
One of the big stories from the Big Ten, a coaching opening. We're going to take a quick break from all of the on-field action to share our thoughts about Michigan and John Paul, who after six varsity seasons is out at head coach. You know, there are two ways to analyze this, or at least two ways. One, John Paul's legacy, what he does, you know, what he did for that program and what's next for him. And then second, the size and scope of what this means for the college cross coaching community and who's likely to step in and lead the Wolverines into the future.
I have strong feelings about John Paul and his legacy. Terry, I think you know that. There's no Big Ten lacrosse without John Paul. In my conversations with Jim Delaney of the Big Ten, you know, Michigan's the key team there to get Big Ten lacrosse. So thank you, John Paul, for what you did at Michigan, getting them D1 and leading to this terrific Big Ten lacrosse, which has been fabulous. The play on the field, the ramping up at Ohio State, Penn State, the TV coverage. You know, I look at John Paul as one of the great entrepreneurs of lacrosse. You know, you had STX with the plastic stick. You got Bob Carpenter at Inside Lacrosse. You got Dave Morrow. But really, John Paul as an entrepreneur, as a guy who built the program from club to D1, has got to be recognized. You know, you compare it to business. Let's say Under Armour, for instance. You know, Kevin Plank takes Under Armour from his basement to, you know, national prominence. Now, going forward, is he the guy to run the company? You know, he's more of an entrepreneur. I'm not so sure. So, and Michigan at this point has to go out and get that proven corporate leader. You know, that guy who can run a Fortune 500 company. And John Paul, to me, was more of a terrific, terrific, one of the greatest entrepreneurs in the game. Somebody else now gets to come in and reap the rewards of his building.
I think what it's a reflection of, to that point specifically, is how specialized the skill coaching Division I lacrosse is. And I think that, you know, my attitude was always John Paul accomplished one of the things in college lacrosse that no one had accomplished for three decades leading up to it. He's clearly a smart and capable guy. I think he deserves the opportunity not only to lead this program, but also demonstrate whether or not he can improve as a Division I coach over the course of his short tenure. You know, it ended up being 6 years, to the point where it satisfies the expectations of, you know, all the Michigan constituencies. It didn't end up happening, and I think that, you know, for someone that's capable of doing that, to not then parlay into, you know, being able to find the path toward Big Ten success, whatever else the standards might have been, shows how, you know, kind of difficult a job being a Division I head coach is. And I think that's important when you think about what's next for Michigan. There's basically been two schools of thought or two demonstrations of thought as it relates to the candidate pool. The Joe Amplo, Dan Shamati types who have done a great job of getting new programs to NCAA tournament level performances. And certainly after we saw Marquette beat Denver last night, that was a very common refrain on Twitter. Joe Amplo just got a call from Ward Manuel, the AD at Michigan. I think that that's a little bit short-sighted. I think it sells short the fact that Michigan can go after coaches who have won national championships. And, you know, who that might be, you know, I don't think John Donosky is leaving Duke. I don't think John Desko is leaving Syracuse. But beyond that, I don't know if there are any real limitations as to who is a serious or could become a serious candidate for Michigan.
Yeah, no, I don't really think I can add to the dialogue here, Terry. I think someone's got to get their folks on the phone, and someone's got to do a piece about what they're looking for in this search and ask them if they'll talk about their process and what they value as being characteristics of the next Michigan head coach. So I think they're going to have the pick they want, and I think people are interested in this job. A lot of it comes down to there'll be some coaches who get raises because of this, which is good. And it'll just be interesting to play out, but I can't really add any insider information. I have not spoken with or have been on campus this year. You know, I didn't do any football games there. Usually that's a great time of year for me to hobnob with the lacrosse administrators.
Well, just a couple more points on that respect. Dan Shamati, Richmond announced on Wednesday night, has received a contract extension. I believe it was a 5-year extension. And then additionally, you talked about the increased commitment within the Big Ten. Penn State just announced a, I believe, $3 million gift for their lacrosse stadium.
Yeah, I saw that. Beautiful.
Yeah, that will include new naming rights. Panzer Field. What a great name. Images of World War II tanks.
No, I don't know about that, but I did see the images, and it's going to be a nice little Thunderdome there in Happy Valley.
Which it already is. I've been impressed by the environment that they've built there. So, all right, before we move on, Sideline Swap is where lacrosse players buy and sell their gear, find deals up to 70% off on heads, shafts, handles, and more, or snag unique gear from college and the pros. Sideline Swap also lets you sell old gear simply and securely. List in seconds. They'll send you a prepaid shipping label when it sells. Visit SidelineSwap.com today to get started. That's SidelineSwap, SWAP.com. Whew! We're almost done. We're halfway through Thursday's action. We're not going to spend as much time on the other conference tournaments as we saw Albany dominate. It's number one versus number two in the America East tournament as they will take on the Binghamton Bearcats, who bested UMBC in one of the five rematches that went the other way from the regular season meeting. Albany dispatches Stony Brook, and I guess there really isn't much more to talk about here. You know, we talk about how Albany's kind of on that hinge point between hosting and not. If they don't host a first-round tournament game, they're likely to take on an opponent who is in their same ilk, whether that be Duke, North Carolina, Johns Hopkins, Penn State, maybe a lot there. On the other hand, you know, a couple of teams whose seasons end in differing fashions. Stony Brook with an early season win over Brown had a lot of optimism. UMBC, after starting winless through the first month of the season, really demonstrated some progress, and I thought under first-year coach Ryan Moran showed that you know, they need some tools in the toolbox. They need some players to arrive on campus. But you know, the degree to which Albany has separated itself over the last 6 years, with the exception of falling in the America East semifinals last year, that might not be as wide going forward as it has been.
Ryan Moran does deserve credit, Terry. That's a good point. And so does a guy like John Galloway at Jacksonville. I'm flying up to Albany later today. Paul and I will have this America East title game Saturday noon on ESPNU. Going to be a little chilly and potentially rainy. Working on my boards, finalizing my boards right now. And you look at Albany, very, very impressive yesterday. Connor Fields with the 7 points. They got really – their shooters from the midfield are dangerous, guys like Kyle McClancy. Adam Osika will be drafted in Major League Lacrosse, one of their two-way middies. They got the skill. Seven times they've won this tournament. Seven-time America East champs. 8 times they've been to the NCAAs under Scott Maher. Here's a quiz for you. How many NCAA tournament games has Albany ever won?
I'm going to go with 3.
Bing, 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 bing. Winner. Winner, winner, chicken dinner, Terry. Yes, 2007 they beat Loyola before losing to Cornell in that epic quarterfinal game. 14, they went down to Loyola and took down your Greyhounds in a shocker, and then lost to Notre Dame in the quarterfinals at Hofstra. Another great game.
One of the best games I've ever seen.
2015, they beat Cornell, and I forget who they lost to in the following round. I think it was Notre Dame again?
Yes,
they lost
in Denver.
In 2015.
Yeah, they lost to Notre Dame in Denver, and that was the Matt Landis Schmeisser Award-winning performance.
They lost to Notre Dame twice, once at Hofstra, once at Denver.
That's a little bit of a rivalry. If those two teams get a chance to lock horns again, look out.
So that's interesting. TD Ireland, completely dominant.
22-23.
How many times do you think I'm going to mention wrestling with TD Ireland? I got to get in a discussion with him today or tomorrow morning about what type of wrestler he was. He won 161 matches, third in the New York State tournament. I am just so jealous of that kid because I know the level that he wrestled at. And now he's just focused on being a great Fogo. And 21-22, is that what it was?
I thought it was 22-23, but either way, he only lost once. So.
And then Binghamton, Kevin McEwen, another first-year coach, 11 wins for this program, Terry. That is something else. They're defense first. I think they rank number 7 in the country right now in scoring defense. They want a slow-tempoed, low-scoring game. They got some issues on the ground. You know, they're not a great ground ball team. And so ground balls will dictate tempo here. I think that's everything in this game. because Binghamton's got some parts on offense. You know, Tom Moore is the key guy, 6'3". He's been around forever, multiple schools, Jacksonville, Denver. But they got some quick guys who are scoring goals now. You know, Joe Licata looks good, and T.J. Tiernan's come to life. This is a tough team. Defense first, though.
So, yeah, I mean, this was a rematch of a game that Albany won 10-4. It was a midweek game. It was leading into the Yale game for Albany. So it'll certainly be incumbent on Binghamton to, as you say, you know, try to dictate the tempo and be competitive.
Yeah, you know, somewhere along the line, they're going to have to stand toe-to-toe and score. But you look at their losses, you know, they lose to UMBC 7-6 in April. Lost to Albany 10-4, lost to Cuse up in the Dome 9-8, and a very good effort. But those are three cases where they don't get to double digits. So, you know, somehow they got to manage a 10-9 win here if you're Kevin McEwen and the Bearcats.
Moving along, a pair of kind of non-competitive chalk conference semifinals in the NEC and the SoCon. Hobart, 15-9 victors over Sacred Heart. Bryant, 12-3 victors over Robert Morris. You know, that sets up a Bryant versus Hobart match from Geneva, New York on Saturday. And then in the SoCon, Air Force 11, Jacksonville 8 ends what had been a storybook month for the Dolphins. And Richmond 13, Furman 6, a repeat of last week's performance that secured the number 2 seed for the Spiders. The rematch is set for Saturday, Air Force versus Richmond in Robins Stadium. For the Spiders and Coach Dan Shamati, this is who they want. This is a team that not only beat them in the SoCon Championship last season, it also knocked them out of the NCAA tournament playing game in 2014. So a nice rivalry emerging between the Falcons and the Spiders.
I got a question going forward for these leagues. Who do you anticipate being in the play-in game? And then automatically having to play the number one seed. How is that selected? Is it regional? Is it strictly RPI and resume? Fill the fans in about how that's going to work.
So that is resume-based decision. It is at the discretion of the NCAA Championship Committee, the same way that any other selection in, out, or seed is at their discretion. Used to be believed that this was purely dictated by the RPI. So the two lowest resume teams will be funneled into that first round or playing game that will lead to the number one overall seed in the first round of the NCAA tournament. I think there's fair expectation now that Richmond and Air Force have both emerged and both have quality wins that the winner of the MAC and the winner of the NEC will play each other. From a regionality and geography perspective, that could determine or could have some impact in determining who ends up being the number one seed as a tiebreaker. I think that if two teams' resumes are really close to one another and there is a clear regional emphasis on the winner of the playing game, that could very well be what is maybe a dictating factor in terms of who draws that number one seed. You know, certainly that's just an unfortunate reality of what we have to deal with. Detroit Mercy plays Monmouth today, as well as Canisius versus Marist in the MAC semifinals. And like I say, the NEC semifinal is set between Bryant and Hobart. So some pretty significant geographic regionality there. If Detroit Mercy wins, obviously they're a Western team. You know, got a fair amount of representation in the middle of New York State with Canisius, Marist, and Hobart. New England with Bryant, and then a little bit further south with Monmouth out of New Jersey. So definitely something to keep an eye on over the course of the next 36 hours.
Yeah, and real quickly, I just want to add, you know, there's some confusion on Twitter last night. I don't know confusion, but how this tournament works. Again, it's 9 automatic qualifiers, 8 at large. It's a 17-team field. It's not the best 17 teams in the country, okay? And that's where I think people don't understand what this is. It's the 8 best teams in the country and the 9 automatic qualifiers. So in reality, it's about the 12 best teams in the country and then 5 or so AQs. And it's great for the game. Do those AQs give us Division I sustainability at 71 different schools? So I don't want to hear it that those teams don't belong.
Absolutely. I've been on that bandwagon for more than a decade, and I think that the proliferation of conferences and programs all across the country is directly attributable to the automatic qualifier. Quint, we've got one premier league to talk about.
The Ivy League semifinals, 3:30 ESPNU. Brown takes on Princeton, followed by 6 p.m. Yale taking on Penn. The Bulldogs are the host. This the tournament in general promises to be a high-scoring affair, but Brown versus Princeton in particular was a 30-goal game the last time these two teams met. I don't know if it's fair to say that they have like-minded styles, but obviously Brown wants to put the pedal on the metal, and Princeton, because of guys like Zach Currier, are not afraid of playing in transition themselves.
No, they can score with Michael Sowers. Terrific freshman numbers, and a team who's overachieved and done a really great job for their first year head coach, Matt Madelin. Why do I like the underdogs in both these games for whatever reason? I haven't spoken with Chris Cotter.
I have an answer. Like them because both of the favorites are coming off of losses.
Yeah, I see Penn's victory over Virginia as a springboard. I think Brown really turned things around in the last three or so games of the season. I have not spoken with Chris Cotter and Ryan Boyle, who have the call of all three Ivy games. It's a one big league. These are extensions. This is a round of 64 tournament game that you can get to watch today. But I don't know, just a gut feeling, and I haven't seen much of Brown. I haven't seen much of Penn. But my gut feeling is that these underdogs and this league, the number one seed, has struggled. So hosting and being the number one seed has not been advantageous.
Well, in addition to both of the favorites having lost, they're both winners of the previous meeting. And we've talked about how losers of the first meeting were 5-7 on Thursday. Certainly Penn having lost to Yale 14-12 and Princeton having beaten Brown 21-11 has the attention of both the Penn and Brown coaching staffs heading into this one. But you mentioned the incredible way in which Princeton has exceeded expectations. I'm very interested in that. So why don't we go ahead and hear from senior midfielder Zach Currier, who has been a tremendous pace setter for this team so far this season. And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Zach Currier, Princeton midfielder whose entire team is preparing to take on Brown in the Ivy League semifinals, 3:30 ESPNU on Friday. Zach, this is a really exciting matchup, two high-powered offenses. What's your thought, what's your expectation for this rematch against the Bears?
They've got a lot of weapons on offense and as well as defense, so we can't take them lightly at all. We had a good game against them in the regular season, but I'm sure they're prepared to defend everything that we showed them that game. So it's going to be a battle, and it's just going to come down to who wants it more. And whoever wins the ground ball battle is probably going to end up winning the game as well. So we're just going to be trying to play our hardest and fight for every ground ball, fight for every play, and win every one-on-one battle that we can.
You emerged 21-11 victors over Brown on April 1st in that first matchup. And you mentioned the ground ball battle, and you kind of set the tone for your defense, or for your team, excuse me. You've picked up 114 ground balls this season, many of which have come from the faceoff X, where you've taken 170 draws and won 55%. How does that element of your game influence everything that it is that you do at the offensive and defensive end of the field? Taking faceoffs, winning ground balls, how does that permeate the rest of your game?
If I pick up the ball, I can go play offense. So that's definitely an incentive for me to try to get it. And then it keeps me off the defensive end of the field. But I just try to get into a groove early. And the way I do it is by picking up ground balls and then start getting confident and get my teammates all pumped up. And then they feed off me, I feed off them. So it's definitely a big part of my game and something that I pride myself on. So if there's ever a loose ball, I'm fighting as hard as I can to pick that thing up.
A lot of people call you a throwback midfielder. I don't necessarily know exactly what that means, but I think people are trying to say that you play both ends of the field. Do you consider yourself a throwback midfielder?
I take it as a compliment. I don't really know what it means either, but the people that I have heard say it, I think they relate it to the fact that people used to play both ways. 10 years ago, and I definitely think it's a cool thing to have people think that I can play an all-around game, which I think I can as well. But I don't really know how to like how it would relate to my game, other than playing both ends of the field. But for my game, I'm just going to try to pick up as many ground balls as I can so that I don't have to play both ends of the field, because defense is really tiring. So, yeah, I'm not really sure.
How much of that do you attribute to your background and your, you know, kind of coming up as a box player, and how important it is, you know, for either, you know, in box, you know, there are offensive players and then more versatile players, and, you know, your experience kind of playing both ends of the floor there?
Yeah, definitely a big help growing up playing box, because we don't have attackmen and midfielders and defensemen in box when you're growing up. When I was growing up, you played both ends of the floor, and the saying was up, down, off. So you start on the floor and you play defense. You go up the floor, you play offense, and then you come off on the way back. It definitely helps growing up playing box so that you're a more well-rounded player, whereas you're not starting off and the first day you're picking up a lacrosse stick, you're only playing attack or you're only playing defense. So that part definitely helps.
The Princeton Tigers currently sit 9-5, finished the Ivy League regular season with a 4-2 record. One of the biggest differences from last year to this year is the offensive efficiency. Currently have the 5th rated offense by efficiency metrics. And a lot of that probably has to do with the arrival of Michael Sowers, a freshman attackman who's put up 77 points to this point in the season. What's it like playing alongside him?
It's pretty special being able to see a player like that play. Especially doing the things that he's doing as a freshman. He's come in and he's a student of the game, and he knows the game better than anybody, and his work ethic is second to none. So seeing him put up the points that he has this season is really, really cool thing, and he definitely deserves all the recognition that he's gotten because of all the work that he puts in behind the scenes. And just him... His chemistry with Gavin McBride is also another pretty incredible thing. They're always watching film in the coach's office with those two. And after practice, they're always working on set plays. And if I go here, you go there and all that stuff. And Gavin's put up over 50 goals this year, and most of them have come from Michael. So it's pretty special to be able to watch him. And it's pretty special to be able to watch him play along with Gavin McBride as well.
It's not the only change in the offseason. Matt Matalon having taken over for Coach Bates, building out a new staff with Coach Bernhardt and Coach March, and then Coach Tuma as well. What's it been like getting used to the new coaching staff, and how do you feel like the transition has gone as you reflect on the last year?
It's been different. We've had, I think this is our 4th defensive coordinator that we've had, so it hasn't been easy for our defensive players to go from year to year. But Matalon has been with us for all 4 years, and he's a great guy, really approachable. He's made the transition as easy as it could be, but definitely difficult to go from everything you know going out the door and having a new head coach come in, and then everything's changing. So it kind of feels like a freshman again with everything that's changed. But Coach Matalon and the staff have done incredible job making that transition as smooth as they can.
And lastly, you know, just as you reflect on your 4 years at Princeton and analyze the opportunity that lies ahead, heading to Yale for the Ivy League tournament, an automatic qualifier for the NCAA tournament on the line, you know, what is your mindset as a leader on this team, and what are you communicating to your teammates to make sure that you finish on a note that you're pleased with and proud of?
Since my time at Princeton, we haven't won this tournament, and none of us on the team have played in an NCAA tournament team, so or NCAA tournament game. So if we want to do something that we've never done, we've got to prepare like we never have before. Which is, I think Jesse Bernhardt, our defensive coordinator, had a quote from, I think it was Thomas Jefferson the other day before practice, something similar along those lines. So. My message to the team would just to not have any regrets and not hold anything back, because as soon as that whistle blows and the final buzzer goes, if we're not on top at the end of the game and we could have done that one thing or worked a little bit harder to try to get that one play, everyone's going to be beating themselves up and have regrets. So it's just about putting it all on the line and working as hard as you can, doing everything you can for the team.
If you want to do something you've never done, you've got to prepare like you never have before. What a great sentiment. What a great attitude to have as you head into the ultimate or penultimate weekend of the season, depending on your perspective. Thank you so much for your time, Zach. We really appreciate it, and best of luck this weekend.
Thank you very much.
And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Monmouth head coach Brian Fisher, whose Hawks are 12-3, 6-0 in the MAC, the number one seed, and take on Detroit Mercy on Friday at Marist, the neutral site host of the MAC tournament. You know, Brian, this is a rematch against the Titans team that you guys beat 11-8 on April 15th. And I would imagine that there's a combination of comfort, knowing that you've gone through the preparation process for this, as well as apprehension to make sure that your team is of the right mindset to be able to rematch a team that they had already beaten early in the season. How do you attack that as a coaching staff, and how do you feel like your players have responded?
You know, certainly it's a new and unique experience for us, just entering the conference tournament as the number one seed. And for us, we've been fortunate enough to qualify for the tournament the last two seasons, but have played Marist in the first round. So to see a different conference face is unique for us. But we're excited about the opportunity and going as the number one seed, and with the confidence of a win streak behind us and winning the MAC regular season championship. But more than anything, it's been about staying focused. And when you get to postseason time, and with the little bit of experience we've had the last couple of seasons with it, you know, you're very familiar with the opponents that you're going to see again. So for us, it was just kind of refamiliarizing ourselves with it this week, getting back to work. It's also been a little bit of a challenging week because the first part of this week we were still finishing up our final exams. So finding the balance between, you know, spending a lot of time studying, preparing for exams, and a little bit of time, you know, between those exams, just beginning our prep work again. So we're a day away from being done with everything and being able to put all of the academic stuff behind us and focusing on just playing this weekend. But unbelievably excited about the opportunity and kind of what we've already accomplished and what we hope to accomplish this weekend with this upcoming conference tournament and us coming in as the number one seed.
Your defense is ranked 15th in efficiency. You have not given up double-digit goals since February 25th, and you're coming off of limiting Manhattan to just three. Senior goalie Nick Reschko is stopping 59%, but beyond that, who are some of the personnel that have contributed to the success of the defensive end of the field?
Well, it's the all-inclusive answer is from the top down is Coach Giesen's done a fabulous job with our defense and developing those guys throughout the years with us. It is our fourth season. Those guys are now seniors, and it's a poised veteran kind of experienced group that because of the adversity we've been through both this year and in years past, they're a very poised and kind of savvy group, and they rarely get caught off guard by anything. But he's done a great job developing that talent and developing chemistry with that group. But it's really as a unit how well they all play together. Nick, you know, obviously you see him, he's the last line of defense and he's been playing really well, but the guys in front of him support him really well too, from Ryan Atkinson, Andrew Grayuski, Neil Rupert, who's played both long stick and close. Garrett Pfeiffer as an underclassman has stepped in and been unbelievably solid and vocal and a leader within his own right while only being a junior. Our defensive midfields, we just take pride in how we defend, and that's Greer Wilson, Chandler Vanderbeek, Dylan Schulte, who wears a lot of different hats for us. I think I mentioned Greer Wilson. So Jay Kenzie, those guys do a really good job of being tough and taking pride in how we defend one-on-one there so that they're hard to beat, and then we support them when we need to. So it really is kind of how we play and all-inclusive in terms of, you know, the chemistry we've developed with them, how they've developed over the years, and Coach Giesen with the preparation and work that we put in getting ready for our opponent.
At the offensive end of the field, Bryce Wasserman, a junior attackman, is the leading scorer, 40-point scorer on the season. He's flanked by a really robust number of guys who have gotten into double-digit goals. It seems like that scoring diversity is kind of the hallmark of this offense. Is that a fair characterization?
You know, everything I kind of just mentioned on the defensive end applies to the offensive end as well. I think we're a pretty balanced team. And, you know, Bryce and some of the guys who do have a lot of points, Chris Daly, Eamon Campbell, probably if, you know, we set them up a little bit more because we needed to, they'd probably have even more points, more stats, and would look better on paper. But the way we play and the style we teach is empowering guys to be aggressive and make decisions and, you know, to play unselfish, just team brand of lacrosse. On any given day, it could be Bryce, it could be Amon, it could be Griff Fiegel, Chris Daly, Ty Keene, Dan Bloodgood. You know, so our scoring's been pretty balanced because of that. But obviously, the top guys, Chris Daly, Amon Campbell, Bryce, Ty Keene, Dan Bloodgood, have been great all year for us, and certainly. Overall, the offense has really bought into that kind of style and the way we play. That team brand of lacrosse has really helped us.
You mentioned this is not your first trip to the MAC tournament. So, two-part question. What is the identity of this conference right now in 2017, and how does that manifest itself into a, you know, four teams, 3 days, three games, 2 days conference tournament?
I think the identity of the conference is toughness. The teams that are in this conference tournament, and even the few that didn't make it, just are very tough and are hard to beat from 1 week to the next. We're all very familiar with each other, especially the teams that'll see each other again this weekend. But you know, even though we've had some success this year, many of the teams, many of the games have been a battle. And even though some of the scores might reflect that there was a 3-4 goal difference, you know, some of them went down kind of to the wire and just plays at the end. Gave us in particular a little bit of that separation, but you know, there's some tough teams in conference and some really good coaches who have done a good job over the years. And as I've gotten to know them and know the conference, certainly a lot of coaches in the conference we have respect for, and certainly those teams. So every time we step on the field to play another MAC opponent, we are trying to prepare our guys that it's going to be a battle and a grind, and you're going to have to, you know, overcome and make the plays when the going gets tough, you know, when it's tight to win those games. And for us, fortunately this year with the veteran group that we have, we've been able to win those games and are expecting kind of the same in the conference tournament and to win close games.
Championship set for 10 a.m. on ESPNU. That is the reason that the games are being played in Poughkeepsie at Marist, as opposed to at the number one seed, which had hosted the tournament previously. What does the opportunity to play the crescendo of the MAC season on ESPNU mean to both the league and the two teams that qualify for the championship game?
Yeah, we don't want to look too far ahead. We have a game to play Friday night before we get to Sunday. But obviously, hopefully it'll be us, and for whatever two teams in the conference play in that championship game and play on the ESPNU, will be very exciting. And for us in Monmouth, we were fortunate enough to host a game on ESPNU against Manhattan last week to conclude the regular season. So it was a fun day and fun experience, and probably more than anything, just to have people see Monmouth and see campus and see our facilities while we had a chance to play a game and came out with a win was part of the fun of playing on ESPNU last week. But we're just doing everything we can and trying to stay focused on Friday, and if it works out, we'll have another opportunity to play on television in a championship game. So the television side of it's fun, but it would also be a heck of a ride and a great way for these seniors to end their career to have an opportunity to win it on a championship Sunday.
And that parlays and transitions nicely into the last one for you, which is, as you trace the four-year arc of this program, so much has been devoted to the topic of startup programs, particularly what it means for a senior class who has been the lifeblood of the organization their entirety of time on campus to have one last ride. And so certainly after, you know, Marquette put together a very nice season and winning the Big East Championship last year and taking the soon-to-be national champions to the wire, there was a lot of analysis and focus on teams that were in their fourth season this year. And certainly, you know, with the performance that you guys have put in, Monmouth fit the bill going 12-3. How do you feel like that is a part of the ride? And how do you kind of trace the arc of the last 4 years?
You know, it's really hit home the last 2 weeks because the end has been in sight, and it's going to be bittersweet. And even this morning, even though we're kind of still getting prepared to play in the conference room this weekend, you know, I was doing some work on graduation type stuff for the guys and the graduation ceremony and things of that sort. So it's going to be bittersweet because it's going to be a proud day for our staff, program, parents, Monmouth when this first class of seniors graduates. At the same time, it's going to be a little disappointing because we've spent so much time with them and so much shared adversity and highs and lows with this group that, you know, we'll have a lot of fond memories of them as they become alumni real soon here. But it would be great to go out with an opportunity to play a few more games here. And that's just what we're really focused on, trying to extend our season for a few more days every time we play. So This group has been really special and has meant a lot to us, and we'll be sad to see them go, but happy for everything that they have accomplished here. Whatever happens this year for us in these upcoming days, you know, we'll look back and say, hey, we had a heck of a ride and had a heck of a senior year with that group, and the development of the players individually, the maturation, the growth that they've experienced, both in the classroom, on the field, and socially, and to know that many of them are going on to graduate schools or have jobs already coming out of their Monmouth experience, it just makes it a very, very proud day for us. So it'll be bittersweet when it is finally over, and we're focused on just extending it as much as we can here in the upcoming days.
Well, Brian Fisher, we really appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Enjoy the next 5 days, savor them, and best of luck as you pursue an additional 7 days at least to the 2017 season.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Paul Rabel is one of only three players in lacrosse history to have won a Division I, MLL, NLL, and FIL World Championship. He's also been instructing skill development for the past decade. Passionate about media and technology, Paul and his team have gathered their resources to film hundreds of videos on Paul's technique, favorite drills, and playbook materials, all to live in a single place, accessible anytime, anywhere. It's called the Paul Rabel Experience, and it's a video instruction platform. Of the over 250 videos, each is original and exclusive to members, where Paul has recorded, edited, produced, and uses them himself during the season. Featured videos showcase drills for improving your stick work, dodging, shooting, shooting on the run, cradling, defensive drills, and stick tricks. His instruction is bottom-up, meaning he teaches the fundamentals of each skill first, then discusses the intricacies for the advanced player. In our playbook section, Paul analyzes offensive, defensive, and transition sets. Moreover, each member has access to his fitness routines, powered by the best lacrosse trainer in the sport, Jay Dyer, as well as a nutritional section packed with Paul's favorite recipes and blog posts about how he approaches nutrition to get the most out of his performance. Beyond the content, members have the ability to ask Paul questions. There are comment sections for every video and a contact Rabel feature, where Paul will respond to your questions within 72 hours. Basically, he becomes your personal coach. The Paul Rabel Experience is a promotion going on right now, where you can get your first month for just 99 cents. To take advantage of the offer, go to paulrabelexperience.com, click subscribe in the top right corner, and enter the code ILPOD during checkout. Satisfaction is guaranteed. You can cancel anytime, no obligations. Again, to take advantage of this limited-time offer, that's paulrabelexperience.com and enter the code ILPOD during checkout. All right, Quint, we have bracketology to discuss, and then we are going to let our listeners get out of here on that one. The RPI experienced some small fluctuations as a result of Thursday's game. Into the top five is Ohio State. Out of the top five is Johns Hopkins. Into the top 20 is UMass. Out of the top 20 is Michigan. I mentioned that that means an additional quality win for UMass. It also has significant ramifications within the Big Ten. A surprising number of Big Ten teams had played UMass. Ohio State, the lone team who has a net neutral, given that they had a win over Michigan that they are not punished for. I'm sorry, I misspoke. It's not the Big Ten teams, it's the bubble teams that have the win over UMass. Army, Towson, and Hofstra all have their resumes bolstered by UMass now becoming a quality win. I don't think it's going to lead to much in terms of at-large consideration, because really there's only one storyline. The bubble with Denver's loss is essentially non-existent. I think Rutgers is going to end up being the first team out. I think that the gap between Rutgers and whoever the next team is considerable. It got a little bit wider with Villanova's loss in the semifinals. And here we are. I think that this is a pretty well-defined tournament field.
Yeah, you know, Rutgers, there was a lot of speculation online about a team like Rutgers. But I, you know, I look at their schedule, and I think it's poorly crafted, quite honestly. They don't play out-of-league teams to give them a top 10 RPI win, you know, and there's too much garbage in the bottom end of their schedule. You know, St. John's Wagner and New Jersey Institute of Technology. You go out of conference, you know, Army, I believe Princeton, and those teams have had nice seasons, but there's just not enough there. You know, like you think about Ohio State. Well, Ohio State played really low-ranked teams early in the season, but then they ventured out against Denver and got that win. And that was so big for them. And then they ventured out and you know, got a win at Towson. Towson's turned out to be pretty darn good too. So I just think Rutgers has to reevaluate their schedule because, you know, they lose to Delaware. Even if they beat Delaware, they're still not getting in. that Delaware game does not help you in any way.
It only prevents pain. It doesn't actually add anything to the resume.
Correct. It does not add anything. When you play teams like that out of conference, and you're in the big dog coming from the big dog conference, I just don't understand why you're scheduling those type of games. There's no upside.
Beyond that,
we've seen with North Carolina that it's okay to lose seven games. It's okay to lose seven games because if you play enough top teams and you get your quality wins, you're going to get in even with seven losses.
There's an argument against that because their resume, their schedule is not that different from Duke's in terms of those low-end qualifiers, and that's why Duke's RPI is number 10 right now. They're going to get in despite that because of the quality wins that they've put together and the fact that they didn't lose a ton of those games. They're only 11-4, but wins over Notre Dame. I mean, Man, it's just so interesting. You look at Duke and Rutgers' resumes side by side, and it's really just one quality win that Rutgers is missing. If they had won one more game, they would be right there in consideration with the Blue Devils. And that's what's disappointing about this, is that Rutgers deserves to get in. They have a resume that belongs
absolutely
in the NCAA tournament field, but it's just not big
enough. That's right, Terry. They're a top 16 team, no question about it. And I believe Army is too. And Albany, if they were to lose. If Albany loses to Binghamton, are they getting in the NCAA tournament?
I mean, if Albany loses, they have to displace either Duke or Penn State. I mean, like...
That's not going to happen.
Right. So I would say no. I would say it's not going to happen. I think Albany's, you know, you can split hairs a little bit. Albany's resume is a little bit better than Rutgers, so I think they would fall into that first team out. All of a sudden, the bubble gets a little bit bigger, so to speak, because those two teams' resumes side-by-side with Penn State's, who right now has the number 4 RPI. There's no way they're not getting in. I mean, this isn't one consideration as it relates to distinguishing between Duke and Albany's resume, is that Albany's RPI is 6, Duke's is 10, but Duke's strength of schedule is higher, so it does factor in, and it does count it out a little bit. Not only that, but also Duke has another opportunity to quality win with Boston University this week. I will say the Blue Devils are very incentivized to win that game in a way that they previously weren't.
Yeah, to bounce back off their poor offensive performance as well. I got two more bracketology questions for you. Where does Army stand with an upset win over Notre Dame on Saturday?
They will have 5 quality wins. I don't know. I haven't run a projection to know what their RPI will be. Right now it's 16. They would have to jump significantly. In addition to those 5 quality wins, they will have 2 top 5 wins, which only 5 other teams have right now. So it puts them into an elite class. If they win, I can't say for sure that they would be in. I certainly don't think I would even say after all the dust is settled that it would be a lock. But if they don't get in, they get the ignominious claim as being the best resume ever to have been left out of the NCAA tournament.
Last question. What significant shifts do you see this weekend in the RPI? Like, are these Ivy League teams going to bump up now and pass UMass? What else? How far will Denver fall? What are some significant shifts that you can predict?
It's hard because I've struggled this year with the correlation between, oh, you're playing an RPI, a low RPI team, that means your RPI is going to drop. That hasn't happened, and so I think that what we saw, with UMass's win over Hofstra, their RPI bumped up 5 spots. I don't know. I don't understand the RPI well enough in order to be able to answer that question. So I think that you'll probably see every team that plays, their RPI will go up a little bit, 1 to 2 ticks. And if you see a significant upset, then that team's RPI has the prospect of jumping somewhere between 5 and 7 spots.
I lied. I got one more question. How can the fans get in touch with this bracketology information, with the RPI, and with a chart that may show folks the quality wins and some of the other criteria?
It'll be up on InsideLacrosse.com today, Friday. We will update it Sunday morning with Saturday's results. We will update it throughout this day, Sunday, with Sunday's results, all leading into your crown jewel, 9 p.m. Sunday, ESPNU, the NCAA Tournament Selection Show. Do we have another baseball or softball lead-in? Are we going to have to sit around and wait for extra innings?
I don't know. I'm going up to Bristol, Connecticut. I'm actually going to stay over in Albany on Saturday night, watch the Kentucky Derby at like 6:30, and then watch the Maryland-Ohio State game, 7:30 BTN. Some other action, I think, on the slate as well. I might have the computer fired up. Work out Sunday morning, then drive down to Bristol, Connecticut for the big studio. Hopefully We'll see Van Pelt, Buttrigross, and Melrose, and maybe get those guys to talk some lacrosse. That would be a great segment.
That would be a great segment. That would be a nice little tweak, a nice little perk for all of us who are staying up late on Sunday nights to find out what the NCAA tournament field is. But Quint, we're done. Unbelievable weekend ahead. We had a great Thursday night. If you missed out, we appreciate you listening, but you got to reprioritize because that was not to be missed on Thursday night. But hopefully we get a run back of that on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, heading into the NCAA selection show. We will be back with a podcast Monday, getting reaction and feedback from the coaches, some who are in the tournament field, some who were left out. And we will be back all next week with bracket analysis as well as previews of the first round matchups.
Yeah, very exciting time of year. Check out my article Friday in the Baltimore Sun and on InsideLacrosse.com about impactful seniors who are driving the bus, basically, for these teams. Terry's Bracketology is a must over the weekend. And tons of action on the U. We got the Ivy League. We got the MAC. We have the game Paul and I are covering up America East. And then finally, as you said, selection show. The field develops Sunday night, 9 o'clock, ESPNU, live.
Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.